The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, I should say, and I think that the morning sessions have given us very high standards indeed to meet, not to put too much pressure on our afternoon speakers, but judging by the number of questions and the interest that we had in our audience here today, we know we're off to a very, very good start. And we're going to be finishing one job in a sense, in that our first segment this morning focused on the nations of the world that are already members of the transparency community. Nations of the world, more than 70, some count even close to or over 80, depending upon how you want to count a FOIA law or how you want to count sovereignty as to one particular entity or not, whether it is a distinct nation or not, perhaps slightly over 80. We've covered those and talked about the difficulty of implementation and enforcement of laws once they're enacted. But to finish our survey of transparency worldwide, which is fitting on this day, which we celebrate International Right to Know Day, we wanted to provide some focus on the nations of the world that are not quite there yet, that have been working very hard and credibly toward an openness in government regime, in some instances working for quite some time. And you might recall the United States, it took more than 10 years of active work before that happened. In Japan, it took nearly 20. We're focusing on these nations to identify them as the next members of the community to take that number up near 100, perhaps, because we do have a couple of dozen nations of the world that are moving in that direction. And to do that, we have a couple of gentlemen here who have experience not only with transparency at the international level in general, but experience also in connection with some nations in particular. Our first speaker is Kevin Goldberg, to my far left. And I don't think Kevin minds being described as someone on the far left. Not that I've ever noticed anyway. Not that I've ever noticed anyway. Who's special counsel with a law firm here in the area in Virginia, Fletcher, Hild, and Hildreth. But also Kevin is a special counsel or counsel to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, which is a very powerful organizational force in the openness in government community. And Kevin is someone who has been working in this area longer than you might think just from looking at him. He too started when he was 12 at a very young age and has been active now for what, 35, 40 years, something like that. We can barely keep count.
13
years. Well, it seemed like much longer than that. And during that time, and more recently, he's also participated in the Department of State's Speakers and Specialists Program as an expert speaker on access to government information in the nations of Argentina, Paraguay, Swaziland, and Zambia. So he has been to South America, he has been to Africa, and he has seen things as they work on the ground. And also with us this morning is Nathaniel Heller, who's managing director of a group called Global Integrity, which is a spin-off, if that's a fair characterization, Nathaniel, of the Citizens Republic Integrity.
Center for Public Integrity,
thank you, that actually bears some connection to American University Law School, because its founder is now on the faculty over in the office of, the School of Communication as well. And it's an offshoot of the Center for Public Integrity that tracks governance and corruption trends throughout the world. And Nathaniel's very much aware of the fact that fighting corruption is a big part of international transparency and a big part of the driving force in the nations that are now poised in that direction that we'll be covering today. Nathaniel also is a friend of the collaboration on government secrecy, because this is not just his first, this is his second time as a speaker in our program. He participated on a panel that we had on Freedom of Information Day on March 17th of this past year. So we're very pleased to welcome him back a second time. He must have done a good job the first time. There's no question about that. So let me turn it over to Kevin and Nathaniel to talk about the other nations of the world that are poised and working hard toward joining the international transparency community.
Thanks, Dan. I think I'm slated to go first. And I will talk basically about general themes. What I'd like to do is lay out to you through my experiences both in traveling overseas and in working with journalists from foreign countries that are coming here, exactly what I've learned are the obstacles to enacting a freedom of information law and how we've actually seen in some of these countries what the characteristics are that might allow us to identify the next nations that are likely to pass these laws. I wouldn't begin to try to predict country by country which is the next country to do it. If I could do that, I'd have been picking stocks and getting in and out, well, getting in now at the right ones and out of the wrong ones a week ago. But I don't have those prognostication capabilities. I'll start with, talking about my experiences mainly off of these trips I've done through the Speaker and Specialist Program. And if you aren't familiar with this program, it allows embassies overseas within their budget to invite speakers. They create the topic of their choosing. They create an entire program. And then they bring in a speaker to talk about the topic. And you're working with anybody in the local community that they identify as an important aspect of this democracy. You're giving the U.S. experience. You're not trying to impose that experience, but you're giving examples. And what I always find is I learn more in return. I come home with more than I've probably imparted to many of these people. As is the case today, my trip to Zambia and Swaziland actually had me replacing Will Ferris Yarrow, who I think was supposed to be one of the speakers today. And if you know Will, he would be here, but I understand he's ill. And so I was brought in, and that's what happened when I went to Zambia and Swaziland in June. And I'll start with a true story. Unlike Tom Sussman, I did not have back problems due to the long flight overseas. But when I get back to the airport, I've flown 16 hours from South Africa. I get home, I go through customs at Atlanta, and the customs officer says to me, so where have you been? I said, I was in Zambia and Swaziland. Well, what were you doing there? I was trying to teach local media law students, journalism students, legislators, judges, citizen groups about freedom of speech and in particular access to government information and how it can make their society more transparent. I mean, I literally said that because it was a 16-hour flight and I was that loopy. When I got off, I couldn't even form a coherent sentence. And he looks at me and goes, teach an African governments about freedom of speech and access to information? Well, gosh, I figured that would be like putting lipstick on a pig. I swear that is the exact quote, and I meant to write something to the letter to the editor when that whole controversy came up a couple weeks ago, but that's what he's talking about. And I think it's the apt point for me to start from, because the biggest obstacle in many of the countries that have not yet passed these laws is a tradition of closure and secrecy that has to be overcome. And, I mean, we heard about it with regard to the U.S. experience 7 years after the Freedom of Information Act was passed, you're still not seeing, you know, a huge amount of requests, a huge use of the law. I mean, it's a natural, as I always explain when I talk to these people, is a natural tendency anywhere in the world, even in the most open societies, for governors to be secretive. Even the most open are always secretive, and for the press to push back. And to win this battle and create openness, create a law, you must get, it's a tug of war over the middle, and the middle is the public. And until the public understands and changes their mindset through what they're used to, so through the secrecy they've grown up in, then nothing really will change, because they won't demand openness until they understand openness, until they've lived with openness. We have this in the United States. One of my favorite anecdotes about the passage of the Freedom of Information Law is from my former boss, Richard Schmidt. Dan knew him very well, and he was a huge advocate for openness. He was the counsel to AS&E for 35 years before I took over the job full-time from him. But more importantly, he had been the general counsel of the USIA in 1966 when FOIA was passed. And he wasn't a career bureaucrat at that time. He was a general counsel. But he had been a journalist and then he'd been a lawyer. And he remembers one of the career people walking into his office and saying, well, have you seen this law that they've passed through the House and Senate now? This Freedom of Information Act. And Dick says, well, yeah. The guy says, well, what are we going to do about it? You know, this is our job. We're also in charge of legislative affairs. What are we going to do? Are we going to fight this? And Dick says, well, no, why would we? He says, then, you know, the other guy, the career bureaucrat, says, well, they're going to know everything we do. And Dick says, well, who's going to? He says, those people out there will know everything we're doing. And he says, well, you know, those people do pay our taxes. The reason I always give that story is everybody seems to think that the openness is inherent. It never is. At least in this country, we had a 200-year head start before a law was passed of democracy, of freedom of speech. And again, what we see in many of the countries I've been to, Argentina and Paraguay, are only 20 years removed. Yeah, in about 20 years in Paraguay's experience from dictatorship. Swaziland is still a kingdom. Okay, they still have a king who basically decrees anything that goes on in that country. So you can understand that people, just as we've gotten somewhat complacent about freedom of speech at times, about access to information, they've become complacent the other way, and they're just used to this. And I'm always trying to impart that it may take a generation of non-dictatorial rule of democracy to get to where we need to be in terms of passing laws. And so I think where you're looking at now are the countries in Latin America that have come out of dictatorships and now maybe have had that generation moving forward. Africa may be a little bit behind because their governments aren't as well formed and aren't, and they're still largely, even if it's not a kingdom, working out of a larger single party rule. The former Soviet republics, some of whom haven't passed the law, are also probably a prime area in which you might be able to see things moving forward. But the second part of this is actually, the second part of this traditional openness are the greater conflicts and traditions in the society. One interesting fact I learned in Swaziland, for instance, is, I mean, you have a clash there between Swaziland, the country, and Swazi tribal law and Swazi history and custom that will also come into play in many of these countries that aren't as well developed as the United States or Western Europe. And in fact, in Swaziland, there is a bias against creating paper records of any kind. Why? Because they want to maintain the oral tradition, and in doing so, want to maintain the entire cultural tradition. And so storytelling is the way to pass things on. They're not used to writing things down, which makes it very difficult to keep, you know, when you're looking at a country, it's worth looking at what preceded the country in terms of determining whether a law will eventually even be passed and how well it can be implemented. There are also certain topics which I think are very integral, and we're gonna see how this plays out again, especially in Africa, the topic of HIV and AIDS. It's something that clearly the U.S. embassies are always pushing openness on, and they want people to talk about it, but it's not something that's talked about in these countries. Much like SARS, the SARS epidemic was seen as an example of where non-disclosure can be dangerous to a society, I think AIDS hopefully will push Africa in that direction. Again, Swaziland, a kingdom, the king has 14 wives, okay? Each of his sons has multiple wives. There is an HIV rate of 33.3% in that country. It's the highest in the world. And the U.S. Embassy is just begging somebody to start the discussion about whether the royal family had, somebody in that huge, extended, polygamous royal family has HIV. By statistically, it's got to happen. And they know that until that discussion starts, they will never be able to fully attack the HIV problem. But it's something that, again, that the clash of tradition and placing the king above society versus the need for openness is unresolved at this point. And where you see little things like that, I think, happen in the country are where you'll see openness taking us. The second area that's been a problem is a lack of understanding of what openness really means and access to government information. I mean, we're in basic stuff in many of these countries. In each of the programs I've done, and in fact, in each of the programs I've done, I just did one last week to the International Center for Journalists, to a group of journalists from eight different countries who are coming here on what's effectively an internship program. I always end up writing one thing, and they always just throw it away and basically go back to a level that people in this room would consider basic. I mean, by example, in Zambia, I had 2 days where I had to do a 6-hour workshop on FOIA, running it by myself. One day was for government officials of different branches, and one day was for journalists. And in each day, I followed the same script, and I did not use a single note. I spoke for 6 hours on FOIA, again, at a level you all would just have known as inherently as I did. This is how the law works. This is how a FOIA request is made in practice. These are the problems you're going to bump into. This is why the law is good. Here is a list of handouts of stories where FOIA has been used to, I mean, they weren't even at that level. And that's clearly necessary for people to understand and see the benefit. For instance, in Zambia, one of the key impediments to their passing a law, well, two of the key impediments are, going slightly back to the tradition of openness, one, nobody's actually seen the bill that's been drafted. It's a totally different system than the United States. So the parliamentary council in many of these countries is drafting a bill, and then they send it through the legislature. Well, in Zambia, not even the people on the committee that is charged with reviewing this bill had seen the bill a month before it was supposed to be introduced, and they had no input. In fact, they were looking to the U.S. government to get them copies. That's kind of a bad formula for passing a Freedom of Information law. But second, in that country, their bill came with a caveat, and they were going to have a lot of trouble with this caveat. Caveat was that it also had a media ethics reform component to it, which again shows an inherent ignorance about what freedom of information is. In other words, the Zambian government wanted to regulate the publication side of the press, or any citizen, at the same time it was regulating the news gathering side. And that, you know, they were not willing to drop that. Meanwhile, again, going back to things you and I know, most of my lectures were talking about how freedom of information and access to information actually increases the accountability, not just of government, but of the media, increases the accuracy of the media, and increases media ethics. Because it's very difficult, as I explained to them, to misquote a piece of paper that's right in front of you without being held accountable in your own right. I mean, I took them through the game again that we all know of telephone. And I literally had them play a game of telephone and see where it came out at the other side. And then I had a written piece of paper and put it down in front of them. I said, this is where we started. Do you think at this end you would have gotten this wrong if you read about it? And they sort of were like, okay, well, now I'm starting to get it. It's that level that we're at in terms of understanding. And finally, the media training, however, does have to get better. These people in many of these countries still are not as savvy as the American reporter, as the Western European reporter. They don't know how to ask the questions that are necessary. Another thing I did was, by sheer luck, I woke up one morning and had the Zambian Times in front of me. And I had there were six stories on the front, one was an editorial. Out of the other five, I was able to identify at least one fact in every story, or one way in which each story could have been changed for the better by using a freedom of information law, or by a mandatory right of access to government information. And, you know, so I sort of quizzed him. I said, okay, you have, this story talks about two accidents on the same night at the same corner in this township. What is your first question as a reporter? You know, what is your first thought? And they really couldn't, there were all different answers around the group, but the answer that they didn't articulate was, what was the cause of each accident? I said, well, you know, if you had traffic reports, you could not only perhaps find out to see what caused these accidents, but what had caused accidents at the same corner, or how many had there been at the same corner in the last 10 years? And then you know whether maybe you just have one, two, three, four bad drivers, or whether you have an inherently dangerous corner. And they all sort of, again, start to get it at that point, but it clearly, you know, the basic news gathering concepts clearly weren't there when you started. Third, the lack of organizational savvy in many of these nations. We've talked about non-governmental organizations in earlier sessions, but it's clearly lacking. In countries where that is already established, such as Argentina, I found Argentina was, you know, they have, and all of Latin America has a pretty good non-governmental organizational structure. And the problem is, for every one that pops up, sometimes two end up dropping out of the process, or they're all conflicting with each other, which becomes a big problem. We had that in Southern Africa. There's a big problem with the establishment of non-governmental organizations and how they're going to learn to interact with each other. I'm not going to say it's not a problem here in the U.S. either. I mean, you heard Kristen Adair speak earlier today, and she, as a member of, or as a staff for the National Security Archive, does a lot of work with a group called OpenTheGovernment.org. Well, I, as legal counsel for AS&E, do a lot of work with the Sunshine and Government Initiative. Okay, we are the media equivalent of the OpenTheGovernment.org group. We clash on things all the time, even on the same bill. On the Open Government Act, we had vastly different views as to how certain provisions should be drafted. But in the end, we're better at working with each other. We don't see it as territorially. And I think in these countries where resources are lacking, where the knowledge of how to lobby is lacking, it can become a bigger problem. They also didn't know how to overcome the press citizen distinction, as I call it. One way in which the government is able to knock down many of these bills in any of these countries is to portray it as a handout, much as they do in the United States, to portray an open government bill as a handout to an already unethical press. And then the leaders say, well, look what they're going to be able to know about me. Look what they're going to know about anybody else. They're going to destabilize the country. Meanwhile, these media organizations are not able to come back and show exactly how these bills would impact the average citizen every day. I mean, it's a little difficult, more difficult, obviously, when the average citizen, you know, the literacy rate in a country like Zambia or Swaziland is 70%, and not every citizen would be able to use this bill. And internet access, as we'll see in a second, is much lower than the United States. But the key is that they haven't been able to fully spin these bills into something that helps the citizens. But at the same time, recognize the lead role they have to take in lobbying, because they are many media organizations or companies are the only established organizations in the country, the only ones with any type of funding, with any type of knowledge, and with any type of sort of power to get things done. Finally, talking about infrastructure, it's clearly a problem in Africa. It's a lesser problem in Latin America, because you do have big media companies, especially telecom companies, that are now engaged in television, radio broadcasting. They're able to push things forward. But really in Africa, I mean, where more people are using cell phones than the internet to get information, it's not conducive to government records. And again, a situation where you start from a mostly oral tradition, you don't have an established record keeping, system, and any way in which to review or access these records on the internet. And you're starting from a position of weakness and potential trouble. Now, hopefully the internet will grow. The ITU, I did also attend an ITU conference 2 years ago, the Plenipotentiary Conference, where they're talking about access issues. They're talking about all regulation of the telecommunications industry. But for the first time, coming out of the World Summit on Information Society events that had been held in 2003 and 2005 in Geneva and Tunis, respectively, you are starting to see the ITU talk about access and security issues on the internet. And thankfully, the idea was to grow the internet. We're not restricted. They were very hesitant to pass regulations that would allow countries to set up firewalls at the border, no matter how much certain countries claimed they needed it for protection, serious domestic protection issues, such as Syria coming forward and saying, We had a hacker come in and knock us out for 48 hours, our entire internet infrastructure. We need to have the ability to regulate our borders, our virtual borders. It wasn't happening. So that is something that can help push this forward, hopefully. But finally, more so in the area of infrastructure, we talked earlier about the Reyes case, and Kristen talked about the special rapporteur for freedom of expression in the OAS, which governs Latin America. Very important, and there's not the equivalent component in Africa or Asia just yet, and not the strength of any office, certainly, to push back on these governments in the way that the special rapporteur, and there's actually a new one coming in this month. I don't know if you know the history of the job, but there was one, the current rapporteur who was just leaving office, I think leaves today or tomorrow, Ignacio Alvarez, who's a Venezuelan, and he's being replaced by a woman who's Colombian, who I'm gonna get to meet at the end of the month, and I'm gonna bring this up with her. They're talking about the issues of publication, insult laws, defamation laws, but they're finally focusing more on access to information because of things like the Reyes case, and that's very important and going to be very helpful. Now, that's the doom and gloom, but there's been a lot of positive, too. I mean, in each of these areas, things are clearly getting better. As I said, it's sometimes a generation until things really change, but we're starting to see these changes because, at least in the area of tradition, we are a generation in, as I said, a generation into democracy in many of these countries. We're seeing more laws being passed generally that affect the media. They're not all good. But there is a recognition of a changing media society that will impact the openness discussion as well. And some of the legislators are getting it. More importantly, there's the discussion. I don't know if you heard about the very little play given to this in U.S. media, but on BBC, I was following the 40-day celebration in Swaziland and the Reed Day celebrations. And these are traditional, customary occurrences that the whole country comes together for, where the king is picking a new wife. Is I think we're up to 15, I guess. Maybe this is 14. But this year it came with protests, and they were actually in this capital city of Babane. There was an explosion, and there were about 5,000 people in the streets protesting. And what they were really protesting, in part, was the fact that the king had sent 9 of his wives to Europe on a giant shopping spree. And this was, they're starting, even the kingdom is starting, the people in the kingdom are starting to get it. Okay, we can't just sit back and let the governors run corrupt. They're finally understanding the connection between openness, and they were demanding more democracy with these demonstrations. So it's coming around. There's also better understanding. The knowledge is turning for the better as well. There are more journalism schools, more journalism students. I mean, in each country I went, well, even in Swaziland, only 1 million people, I did 2 discussions at schools, at communications departments of universities. In Zambia, there were 3. And that was just in the capital city. That didn't cover the rest of the country. And these students, they have pretty well-functioning radio stations on each campus. No television yet, but pretty well-functioning radio stations. The problem is, in many of these countries, it's difficult to stay in school or get really good training. We are getting the people who are transitioning out of journalism and into teaching, which is providing a lot of help. At the University of Zambia, I met a woman who had been a journalist not only in Zambia but overseas as well, and she had finally come back to teach. And you could tell her class was a step ahead of everyone else. Meanwhile, at one of the other universities, I'm still getting emails from one student who was so friendly, I gave him my email address. Now he's asking me for $1,000 just to be able to stay in school this semester. You know, that sort of thing still happens. When you're that desperate that you're putting all your chips in an American guy you met once, you are desperate to stay in school, okay? There's more foreign involvement. I talked about the U.S. Speakers and Specialists Program. It's an excellent program, but we're also, things like Sunshine Week are gaining hold overseas. Sunshine Week is kind of migrating south. We heard about Mexico Abierto, that was an outgrowth of Sunshine Week. It's moving into Latin America. They have done, Deborah Gershenandez, the coordinator, has done interviews with people in Spain. And when you get Spanish radio involved, you're going to get other countries involved. And hopefully it'll just continue sort of rippling, the ripple effect will continue. There are more programs in the country, both through the U.S. embassies, but also through people coming here. The program I did with ICFJ last week is an exceptional program. People from all over the world apply for it, and it's the right to come and spend 1 or 2 weeks in DC learning, getting lectured to by people from people like me, and then working alongside an American editor for 3 weeks. I think it is 3 to 6 weeks, depending on the program. Now imagine how great it would be to be an editor. I think they had one from Pakistan, they had one from Namibia, coming right now to the United States, and what you would get to see in the course of campaign coverage and the questions that are being asked and the fact checking that's being done, and you take that back to your country and start writing about these things. It's, that's going to make a lot of change. And finally, things like our Millennium Challenge are taken very seriously in Africa, the USAID program that gives money if you're willing to agree to certain aspects, certain benchmarks of transparency, has proven helpful. I mean, the people at USAID, the AID that I talked to in the African nations, have been very positive on that, and they were very excited to see me coming to speak on these issues as well. The organizations themselves are getting better. This is where I think South Africa is poised to make the best stride. Media Institute of Southern Africa, MISA, is now active, I believe, in 10 countries. They are very organized. They're very knowledgeable. They've done things that we haven't even done here. They have very catchy Freedom of Information song. I should have brought it with me today. It's African tribal beats and singers, and there's like three versions of it on the CD, and it is catchy. I demanded a CD from them to take home with me. And, you know, they play it over the radio every so often, mostly during their own show. And they have taken time on one of the local radio stations to do an hour-long call-in show. And they managed to get the Minister of Information in while I was in the country, and we spent time on a call-in show together. It was about an hour and a half worth of time. And he had people calling in and asking, you know, all kinds of questions about what his office has done in terms of transparency, in terms of, you know, certain controversies that have been occurring in the country. And it was, I mean, people were lining up one after another to get in. One guy called back a second time. He was so angry about the first answer he had gotten that he had to call back in again. But it was very popular, and I understand it is very popular every week when they do the show generally. So that's a good sign. And finally, the infrastructure is changing. I talked about Millennium Challenge. Another reason I keep coming back to Africa, not just because it's the place I've been most recently, but because out of the places I've been, it's the one where I think I see the most potential, because there's more concentration on transparency there. I mean, this year alone, I've been to Honduras, Venezuela, Zambia, Swaziland. Okay, I've also been on behalf of ASNE to Cuba, and twice, and to Chile for the World Press Freedom Committee. Okay, Chile already has its law. Cuba ain't gonna have a law. We know this. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. Venezuela's not headed in the right direction. So really, my knowledge is focused on these two countries, but also because of programs like Millennium Challenge, because of a program at the World Bank called COMGAP, which is Communications and Government Accountability Program, which is focusing its efforts on that continent as well. And because many of the Scandinavian nations are doing better than the US in terms of funding right now. I mean, these nations have this oil money and a commitment to transparency. Well, Denmark is, I think, was on the most recent poll named the most transparent society in the world. And they're trying to outsource that to other countries and trying to give money if the other countries will act in a transparent manner. I know Norway has a program as well, because I've met twice with the Norwegian embassy here in DC about getting money into these types of programs and creating transparency. It's all about anti-corruption for them. That's really where it's at, and they're not concerned about the media, but the money is flowing in that area, and it's very helpful. What we're also trying to do are actually lower expectations in many of these countries. I went into the programs in Zambia and Swaziland. They've had these bills pending, and they're like, what do we have to do to get this bill passed? And I sort of said, slow down. First thing you need to do is make sure you're actually ready for this. And I think they're starting to get that, how difficult it will be. And once they do that, maybe they won't push so forward and end up in a bad bill, because I think one of the better advantages these countries have, and they're starting to realize, is their infrastructure may not quite be ready. So how do they focus what money they have on the best results? And that is probably use of technology. I mean, I think my biggest concern, or my biggest personal opinion as to how we failed FOIA in this country, is to have not thrown enough money at the technology side to allow offices to respond to respond to the increasing amount of requests. Okay, we're all using technology to find records that we potentially want. We're all using technology. It's so easy, as we know, to literally do a self-generating letter, and these offices don't have the money or the computer systems or even the staff to keep up with it. And records are not being digitized in the US to the extent they need to be. And if they can get that in place before they pass their laws, I think you'll see more of a Mexico-India result, because I think that's where those countries were positioned well. Maybe it was luck. Maybe they caught it at the right time. Maybe they caught the FOI bug right when it was going to be most productive in their system, because they've clearly been able to make it a very user-friendly law, whereas we're sort of falling short on that in the United States. And finally, the impact of other countries in the regions. I talked about the ripple effect. Well, in Latin America, the Reyes decision and now Chile passing their law will hopefully help move things forward. And Guatemala passing their law will hopefully help things move forward into Argentina. If an Argentina passes, you'll see Uruguay pass next. You'll see that effect. Clearly, the nations in all of sub-Saharan Africa are already looking to South Africa's law to see what they can do well and what they can't. They not only had brought me in to be a consultant, but people from within the government of each country I visited had been to London and had been to Johannesburg, and they were trying to look at these laws and meld the three into something that's very strong. So when you get the biggest country in the region, hopefully it's the positive domino effect, the way to get other countries moving forward. So again, I said I won't have a prediction as to what country will come next, but clearly I think by now you understand that I'm not looking very positively at Asia. Maybe some of the Eastern European, former Soviet republics, a couple of them. I've gotten calls from embassies in those, U.S. embassies in those countries that are helping set up journalism schools and create better journalism training programs. If they can get that, that'll be a good way of finishing off those countries. But I think sub-Saharan Africa, down near South Africa, they're clearly poised in those countries to move things forward. And Latin America should, by all means, every one of those countries should be there, we all know. And they have the infrastructure to do it. So I think that's a better opportunity as well. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Much of what Kevin was just talking through are many of the same key points, so you'll be luckily spared from a lot of my hot air. But thanks to Dan for having me here again. I expect, since this is the second time, I get a gold watch or some sort of token. But
it's a FOIA poster, actually.
Ooh, that's actually much better. But seriously, thanks. This is a really crucial issue for the work we do. Let me actually kick it off by spending 90 seconds just telling you a little bit, for those that aren't familiar, about our work, why this is a component of our work, and then I'll sort of walk through, in a sense, some of the same issues that we just heard about. Global Integrity is an international nonprofit group that works with teams of journalists and researchers in countries to track governance and corruption trends. We now have a network of about 650 reporters and academics in 91 countries, and the work began several years ago. The mission is fundamentally to fill what we had seen for a long time as an information gap in the broader governance and anti-corruption movement, that there was this rise of the idea that governance was central to development, and by extension, FOI and access to information were seen as crucially linked to economic development. And that was sort of out there as a theory, but and was being pushed as a policy, but there was actually very little good data or reporting to really underpin that. So that's where we sort of tried to step in, and by working with some of the best locals in countries, we thought we could try and generate something that was much more actionable, that could really underpin some evidence-based policy debate and discussion and policy reform. So that's really what we're about, is not advocacy, but actually on the water's edge of advocacy on the information-generating side. We're probably best known for very in-depth, rigorous national assessments of anti-corruption and good governance mechanisms, although we're now going into sub-national work, into sector-specific work. In the national work we've done for many years, one of the components of those assessments, which are blends of qualitative journalism and quantitative data gathering, are assessments of some basic access to information and FOI regimes. So we actually have compiled now data over 90-ish countries over time, and that have given us a lot of evidence to suggest, yes, this is important, but yes, it's also part of a much bigger puzzle that Kevin was alluding to. We look at other issues that are also crucially important that sort of sit next to access to information, like media ownership, libel laws, et cetera, et cetera. Our entire assessments look at a host of other issues, procurement reform, privatization, the justice sector, et cetera, through 300 plus indicators. But there's a healthy swath of that touches on either directly or indirectly access to information, whether through the sort of classic Western style law, or even sort of more casual but important citizen access mechanisms, whether it's political financing and asset disclosure laws to conflicts of interest regulations, et cetera. So that's sort of how we come at this, is having just learned a lot from a lot of friends and colleagues, a number of journalists in many countries. Also, just in terms of backdrop, my own background, having been in and out of nonprofit work, was also spending time as an investigative reporter in the nonprofit sector. As Dan said, I used to be at the Center for Public Integrity, and also on the other side of the FOIA fence in government for 3 years at the State Department, where although I wasn't a FOIA officer, I sort of got sucked into being the guy who responded to a very discrete set of issues when it came to U.S. nuclear policy in Europe. So I've been actually the responder, literally, and also the requester, and now sort of outside of the whole back and forth. If nothing else, I've sort of suffered on both, you know, with indefinite multi-year delays as a requester, and then on the responder side, you know, just being buried in requests, even though I've got a lot of other work to do. So I can appreciate, all sides of the argument. Let me sort of try and both pick up where Kevin left off and touch on some of the challenges, I think, as we take up this topic of sort of what comes next, what countries are next, what are these trends. I think one of the big ones that we have started to see when we look at countries sort of on the cusp or that have just adopted these laws is this issue of the implementing mechanisms. This has really, I think, come to the forefront of this debate. There's been, obviously, over the past two decades, or for the better part of it, a big, big, healthy push to get the laws passed, which is obviously fundamental and crucial, or the regulations or whatever the sort of the underlying code is. So that's fantastic. The problem has been, and I think there are a number in this community that that agree, we sort of got there, and now it's sort of the, well, so what sort of question. This is particularly dramatic and you know, really crucial in parts of Africa, elsewhere in South Asia and Central Asia, in the very poorest of the poor developing countries where there is zero capacity, as we heard. You know, great, so even if we have a world-class model law, is there any staff to respond to this thing? Is there any sort of technological base, even a record system? I mean, it's just, you have no idea until you've sort of been there, of course, and many of us in this room have, just how terrifically difficult this is, despite, you know, if we got everybody in this room to draft a great law for country X, just how difficult it still would be. This really came out to me when I was in February down at the Carter Center. I'm sure there were a number of people here at a big global FOI conference, and the Carter Center has done a lot of really important work pushing this advocacy campaign. And even there, amongst the true believers, there was a strong sense of angst that, well, you know, sort of shit, we've got now 75 countries with these laws, and we don't really know sort of what comes next. And as Kevin said, we don't really know what to tell governments when they say, show us the impact, whether it's from the media side or from sort of the public interest side. So I think that is one of the big things, the big elephants in the room out there, is there is a huge need for some serious research and sort of case study work, but also in terms of the policy work and the advocacy campaigns to get pretty serious about not sort of shifting from the advocacy side, but now complementing that with some very good evidence-based demonstrable work on impact and, secondly, implementation. There are, of course, some recent success stories. Both India and Mexico, I think, do point to cases where you did have resources brought to bear to try and really stand up serious implementation mechanisms. The question is, really, are those the exception or are they going to be the rule? In Mexico, you had, you know, tens of millions of dollars from, you know, foreign donors. That's going to be pretty hard to come by in every single circumstance. So that's sort of item one is, yes, the advocacy has worked. We've got 75 plus countries and growing with laws, but how do we actually implement this thing? The second one, which is sort of, I think, a few components of this, is to sort of step back and think seriously that FOI and access to information, I think, is really just part of a bigger puzzle. And it depends really what your puzzle is, but it's only one slice of effective governance reform or anti-corruption. It's only one slice of media reform, and frankly, it's one and an important but small slice of just broader socioeconomic development. And I think that is one of the challenges for those, including myself, that of course want to push this agenda, is to realize not only are there these capacity issues, but again, these are not panaceas. That even when you have the best case scenario, even when you have the model law, the model regulation, maybe even the implementing mechanism, we can't really expect, you know, sort of overnight transformation. There have been, I think, in recent years, several parallel or sister issues that have helpfully been identified as part of a basket or a bundle of parallel reforms that seem to be important when we're pushing sort of the pure access or ATI or FOI agenda. One are sort of the collection of issues around the disclosure and transparency on lobbying, on political financing, and on personal asset disclosures in countries. The good news is often when, I think in most cases, when we do get FOI in place, these seem to come along with them. But there are plenty of countries, particularly in Africa, where we have either a constitutional right or even a more specific law, but then these others are sort of left behind. And when you don't have any sort of citizen or media transparency into some of those really crucial conflicts of interest areas, it does undermine, to a certain extent, the regime. A second issue that I would identify would be the need to look deeper into subnational or local level access to information. Plenty of really good national laws, again, 75 plus, but again, think of Nigeria, which is on the cusp. You know, I don't, maybe somebody here knows more than I do. It's not entirely clear whether that law, if, you know, sort of God willing, it's ever finally passed, is actually applicable to the states, which, much like the US, much like in Argentina or Brazil or China or Mexico, are fundamentally important when it comes to governance, growth, and anti-corruption. There's a lot of power, authority, and budget at the Nigerian state level. Does that law cover it? Does it have jurisdiction? You know, we'll see. But that's a big, I think, issue that has been tended to be overlooked, is to claim success, I think justifiably, at the national level. You know, if only 20% of the good information is up there and 80% is down at the local level, how effective is the law? A third would be, and I won't belabor this because it was already touched on quite well, but just general press laws or lack thereof, which I think are a better way to think of it. So making sure that as these FOI laws are put into place, that there are appropriate protections for just sort of the basic freedoms of the press. I think a scarier issue for us that we have seen now cropping up are issues of media ownership and the complete lack of regulation. So in many countries, and you can find some scary examples in Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, the Baltics, and elsewhere, where you now have most of the major or all of the major media houses being owned by serious political players or just politicians outright, members of parliament, cabinet ministers, former prime ministers, who own and run the major TV and broadcast stations, radio, and even internet and print media. You know, I think that generates a fairly problematic conflict there. The longer that is let to cement, the more difficult it's going to be to make much use of this, because then you start to get into the really tough self-censorship issues with editors and owners quietly behind the scenes, not even saying it, but making it clear that certain issues are taboo and maybe you shouldn't file that FOIA and maybe you shouldn't report on these issues. So I think that issue of ownership, particularly where it becomes one of cross-fertilization between politicians or political players and media houses, is a really key one that has to be thought of as part of this complementary basket. And two other things quickly on that basket. One would be media professionalism and training. I think it was a great point that Kevin made about not using that as sort of a scapegoat or a red herring by government. At the same time, as we were saying, this is a big issue. And you know, you've seen it, Kevin, I've seen it in so many countries. I mean, you're lucky if you find five pretty legitimate reporters that I think would really match up to our vision of not even an investigative reporter, but just a solid political or economics reporter. It's just hard. And the lack of capacity is really, really, incredibly deep. And I think corollary to that, defamation and libel issues, of course, have to be brought along. So I think all of those that I just sort of ticked off, as we have seen it through our experience, can be really powerful, to use the Pentagon phrase, sort of force multipliers to an FOI regime. That when some of them or all of them are brought along with the passage of FOI and RTI, you start to really see some tangible benefits. Let me take off just a few more things in terms of some of these challenges, and then I'll try and wrap it up. The capacity issues that Kevin mentioned are absolutely fundamental. To give my own dramatic example, I was in Timor-Leste in March, which is the world's newest country, 6 or 7 years old, and still a place with basically one road in the capital city. They have nine prosecutors for the country, three of which still live in refugee camps. And you know, there's a refugee camp right across from the airport when you walk out. And you know, there's a couple of decent reporters and editors, you know, but these are mainly kids who are trying to do the right thing, but have never really, you know, if they've gone through high school, maybe that's a good thing. And so it just gives you a pretty powerful reality check that, I mean, you're not gonna be doing Woodward and Bernstein sort of investigative reporting. And even if there was a law, would anybody really get it? I mean, you really are starting from scratch. So I would just echo that we have to be very realistic in a number of these contexts about either sort of trying to implement an American or Western model, just because the resources are completely either non-existent or incredibly thin. Related to that, I think, is the need to step back and think about sequencing. And this gets into some bigger macro issues, but you know, this is what very few want to talk about, but there's sort of been a push agenda from the access to information and FOIA community, which I think generally is a good thing, not to let up. But it does make one wonder, in, let's say, a Timor-Leste context, is that really where we should be spending political and financial capital in the short or medium term? Maybe it is, and maybe there's good arguments, but I think there's been sort of a blind adherence to the idea that this has to happen. And of course it does, but then when we step back and think realistically about the limited resources, you could make persuasive arguments that, you know what, let's just try and get judicial reform and the courts up and running, you know, before we ever try this thing. Or let's think about civil service reform or procurement. I mean, there's always 1,000 things to fix. And so it's going to be a question in some of these countries about prioritizing and thinking pretty realistically about, can we set certain reforms aside and frankly sacrifice them in the short term in order to sequence things a little bit better. And lastly, I think is really an issue as it comes out of managing expectations. And I talked about sort of the panacea habit. We're not going to get sort of, I mean, even in Mexico, I think you find a lot of people who are deeply involved with that process who today are, I think, a little, I don't know if jaded is the right word, but a little disappointed or something that we sort of haven't had these sort of breakthrough case studies yet. I mean, there have been some, but I think there was a hope that this would sort of radically transform the public discourse. And, you know, maybe it will, and maybe this will take 10 or 20 or 30 years. But the reality is, you know, again, I think FOI is central and crucial, but it is part of a broader basket of reforms that have to happen at some point along the way. And, you know, until you do, there will have to be a need to manage those expectations and keep them in check. I said that was the last thing, but in terms of my predictions for countries that are next on the list, I would actually agree strongly that probably Latin America and some of the former Soviet countries. If you want to look at interesting, really effective FOI regime, look in the Baltics. I just was in Latvia 2 weeks ago, and I mean, they do a lot of stuff that would put the U.S. to shame in terms of, you know, disclosure on the internet, access to everything on the internet, on the web. I mean, it's, you know, we just got Farah online here this spring or something. It's just sort of mind-boggling that when you have a clean slate, which you wouldn't wish on any country, that you can actually do some pretty interesting things. And that is one of the benefits, frankly, for some of these emerging democracies that are coming on board to this movement, is we don't have to sort of muddle through and untangle 100-plus years of kind of messy half-band-aid solutions that were there in the past. You know, if you can do it right, you've got a pretty exciting chance to put it into place in an effective way. Nigeria, of course, is kind of the one that's being watched, but it's been watched for years, so I don't know. I don't have a lot of faith. I think the issues there are much, there's a reason that bill has been tabled year after year, and I think it really has to do with the patronage networks that drive politics in that country, and I'm not sure that until those networks are broken, regardless of who the president is, that we'll ever really see that law come into force. The Guatemala case, I think, is a very exciting one. We've actually been talking to the vice president's office there for a number of months about trying to support sort of an assessment process to look explicitly at the implementation of the bill. And I think they are being very smart in saying, look, we need to really track this thing and know if it's helping or hurting or, you know, is benign, just so we have a sense of how to sell this publicly. So I think there are some nice, you know, examples, and there is hope on the horizon, to put it dramatically. But again, I sort of come back to all this as really a piece of a puzzle. It's a crucial piece, but there's a lot of other pieces that have to be in place for this to really work. And, you know, certainly the Western and the American experience, I think, bears that out.
I think we might have a number of questions from our audience, but let me start you off with one. And I perhaps already know the answer to it, I'm not sure, so you may deem it to be a rhetorical question, but for each of you, if you had to identify among all the factors, the pieces of the puzzle that come into play between taking a country from poised to now having a good working regime, in other words, putting it over the edge, so to speak, what factor do you think would be singly most important or most significant? I think I know Kevin's answer, but maybe I'm wrong.
What's my answer?
I think Kevin would say it would be a healthy and aggressive, successfully pressuring media group within the nation.
That's a clear component, because again, in many of these countries, you have people living outside the capital that don't read, that all their information comes from community radio, for instance, in Zambia, in the part of the population that lives in you know, the Copper Belt, which is the industrial area. They're all getting everything from community radio. That's important. And but I think that's very important. I think infrastructure is huge in these countries. I think they would need capital beyond their beliefs. And in fact, one of my notes to myself about things that Nathaniel said was when he talked about sequencing, and that ties into money. One of my actual recommendations that I said, I told journalists in Zambia, since they're closer to passing a law than Swaziland, I told them that I was going to tell that their legislators, hopefully as a way of brokering something that might actually get to a bill, is you may want to identify portions of a bill or do the whole bill in terms of a delayed implementation. Mm-hmm. Okay, this section, much like we did in the Open Government Act, this section doesn't take effect until 1 year from now. This whole bill doesn't take effect for 18 months. Because that allows the infrastructure to be built, and you don't want to get ahead of yourself. And, But either way, it's going to require money in many of these countries. They don't have anything but an untamed file cabinet.
So regardless of anything else, the country has to be ready first.
Yes. I mean, hell, I'll give you the most extreme example. And I was in the Ministry of Information building in Zambia doing a program to different people from different areas of government. And I go down the hall, and I go to the bathroom. And I walk in the bathroom, and I happen to notice that there's no toilet paper in the stall. So just out of curiosity, walked each of the stalls. Nobody else is in the bathroom. No toilet paper in any of the stalls. Go to another bathroom, same thing. They don't even have toilet paper in the bathrooms in these countries.
Are you suggesting that we ought to have a new litmus test?
There's a long way to go.
For whether a nation is ready for a FOIA?
There's just a long way to go to get this all built up. And so it's worse than even I imagined in terms of infrastructure. And again, this was a government building. I was in the same hotel that Laura Bush stayed in when she did her African tour.
But it must have had TP back then, right?
They had, well, but what I'm saying is it's the best hotel in the capital city of Zambia, and the internet access was infuriating. Absolutely. I mean, you're just sitting in your hotel room, and they're calling it broadband, and for any of you that have not traveled to these countries, it is, you didn't think, I mean, I don't know why my expectations perhaps were higher than they should have been, but you just figure in today's day and age, in a capital city, in a hotel where the First Lady of the United States has actually stayed, it would be sufficiently international to have, at least in that one hotel, some kind of real broadband access. And it was dependent on the time of day, whether you're going to get on at all. 15 seconds, you would be off and have to it's unreal. And if you don't have that, I don't know how you can build an FOI system from the ground up.
Okay, so pressure from healthy media groups is important, but you have to have the infrastructure there first. That's what's key.
I think the infrastructure is going to be more important. Well, no, I think the infrastructure is more important in the long run, I think.
Okay. Really. I have a guess as to Nathaniel, but I don't want to be too presumptuous as to give it to him beforehand.
All right, well, I would actually vote for just political will and senior leadership as kind of a missing ingredient that can be what pushes countries over the top, in the sense that I think that, you know, it's a hard sell, and not for the wrong reasons, to sort of, you know, lobby on these issues. I mean, the tangible benefits, as we've been saying, are not always demonstrable and tangible. So sometimes, you know, I think it will come down to leadership at the very senior level saying, look, I don't care, we're just going to do this. And that's how it ends up happening. That's the tipping point. Not always, but I think you can say with some confidence, if you don't have senior support for these reforms, you can forget it. And despite all the highly coordinated advocacy by grassroots and international groups, you have almost no chance.
And this is, just to interject, this is where things like defamation and insult laws come into play, and the unanticipated consequences and how it all blends together. Because you talked about media ownership being very important. And if the only media ownership is from the party in power owning at least a portion or all of it, or having their cronies owning the station, well, then you're not going to get critical coverage. And if you have a country where even truthful statements are punished under insult laws, or as they're called in Latin America, desacato, then I don't care what kind of information you're able to access. You're certainly not going to publish it for fear of being thrown in jail. And if you're in a kingdom, you know, as you look at the Swazi law that's been proposed, and it exempts the king or anything related to the king from its law.
Is that about half the nation, by the way?
Pretty much at this point, yeah. Well, I mean, really what you have in that country, and with regard to anything, and certainly access to information, is it's like you're playing bridge, and the king always holds the trump and can play it whenever he wants to. It's like, okay, we're going to do this today. Yeah, I don't really think we're going to do this today. We're going to go, the king can just jump in and say, we're going to go a whole different direction on that. And that's the way things are. And you're right. And so you get that from the top down, that willingness to be subject to something. Anywhere in society, then you're certainly not going to get any accountability through an access law.
Well, Nathaniel, when you said political will and leadership from the top, that was not exactly what I had in mind. But let me see if I can put words into your mouth to get you closer. I'm going to guess, tell me if I'm wrong, that one of the driving forces, if not the major driving force in reaching that tipping point of political will and leadership, is a recognition of the need, the utility, and the great need of fighting corruption through transparency.
Yeah, no, I think that is a very important point. And that's why I think in the development world so much, and I mean developments, not developing, so in the development community, that sort of industry of development practitioners, I think that's why so much of FOI work takes place in a broader context and under the umbrella of anti-corruption. It's also what gives the multilaterals and bilateral aid donors entree into this issue. And if you think of their mandate, which they can't touch politics or the political system, the World Bank, the UN, and others, the best way into this, because a lot of them believe in this, you know, these very same issues, the only way they can get in and to play is through the anti-corruption framework. And so I think you're right, and that ends up being sort of the vehicle through which FOI is sort of transported from start to finish. And so, yeah, I think that is crucially important. This whole, by the way, the whole thing on Swaziland, the interesting counterexample to this is somewhere like Bhutan, where you did have a king, yes. You know, sort of just because he's a smart, enlightened guy, sort of step away from power and open up the democratic process in the last year or so. You know, maybe we'll get FOI there. So, you know, you have two, there are dramatic examples. You know, Swaziland is really sort of the negative example, and then you do have the crown of Bhutan's, where from the top, for whatever enlightened reason, truly just said, you know what, let's have election, and you know the guy's pretty committed to it. So
I would go and check the stalls just to be sure, as the ultimate test.
Well, that was Zambia. Swaziland is actually a really peaceful place. I mean, that's what made this 40-40 day kind of demonstration so shocking to me. Is the whole time I was there, it was like it was the nicest, most just laid back country. I mean, there's a reason. It's not just the mountains are the reason. The topography, they call it the Switzerland of South Africa, or the similarities of names. It's it's just the people are very laid back, and they're used to it. They live pretty decently there, you know, as far as an African country goes. And so there's not much upheaval. Is what made it all so surprising there.
How about from the audience? Any questions for this panel? Yes, sir. I'll pass you the mic. Just hold it low.
Thanks. Regarding the resources issue, I was wondering, are there any international groups that are pushing for really low level, like relatively resource inexpensive things like, hey, maybe at the municipal level, at the village level, passing a local ordinance that, hey, anyone who wants to can go into City Hall and look at the records room, just to get that norm established. Is anything like that happening there?
World Bank.
World Bank is.
I think there's some really sporadic ad hoc things, but there are some case study projects and kind of one-off things. But I mean, part of it, I think, is, at least in my own experience, we've seen will depend on the sort of, for lack of a better term, the type of country. This is a really small, unitary country where the local level just doesn't matter, both administratively, politically, and otherwise. If it doesn't happen at the national level, it's almost impossible to find the resources or the political will. However, if it's, you know, a U.S. context, the Mexico and India, China, et cetera, not that that would always happen for lots of other reasons, but at least where things matter more down at the grassroots level, then you have a better chance. Again, there are some bank projects and other ones at the sort of the micro grassroots level, but I don't know of any other particular group that's sort of focused on pushing resources out. The problem, of course, or the challenge, is even if you had a $1 billion to do that, there is no capacity to absorb it in most of these countries at that level. You know, you think the national ministry is a mess with no toilet paper, try going, you know, to the local district office, you know, maybe it's got a door or not. But I'm serious, I mean, it's that rough in a number of these countries. So again, it's a question of not just the money, but do you have any capacity, anybody educated, any professionals at that level who could even absorb those funds and manage them well? My bet would be no. So what is this chicken
and let's egg? Let's not forget that the U.S. situation impacts what's going on in these countries. Trying to get money now to these foreign countries becomes more difficult when every media organization in the United States is asking for a handout, trying to get their funding now, and everybody's fighting for that. There's only so much money to be going around, and that's the problem. Is the U.S. is now U.S.-based organizations are really trying to take a bigger share. What we're trying to do in that regard is tie a more general issue to transparency. Again, you know, the Scandinavian countries trying to fight anti-corruption, and we're able to show, obviously, the link between transparency, but more and more people trying to get creative and going to, say, to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, saying, you're trying to improve health care around the world. Yeah, everybody's trying it. My God, every media organization in the U.S. right now is trying to get money out of the Gates Foundation. Yeah. They've never asked it before. And, you know, but we don't have a chance. But maybe, you're just hoping, maybe, and this is how desperate people are getting, is why I'm bringing up the example. They're just trying to show how, okay, you need openness to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish substantively in any of these countries. So funnel a little that way. Some countries, though, are, and I think Africa is going to be clearly a little different, perhaps, than some of the other parts of the world. Talk about the top-down versus the bottom-up attempts. Africa, you really do need it, any of the countries, and they're starting to do this in each of the countries. You do need to do a grassroots, bottom-up campaign, and I'll say that one of the people I met in South Africa, in Southern Africa, was working cross-border, but one of his issues in Swaziland specifically was to go tribe to tribe and explain to each tribal leader, because that's what it takes in these, some of these countries that have different tribes. You know, Zambia has 8 tribes. Nigeria, you talked about the there's a lot of factioning and political process. Well, you almost have to go to each of those and get them to sign on first, and then you can move it throughout. Because if they block the local community, it's never going to happen there or anywhere else.
Well, speaking of the U.S. role, that's a bit of a segue into our next panel. And let me ask, if I may, a concluding question that might provide a bit of a setup for it. From each of your perspectives, looking at things at the other end, so to speak, at the receiving end of any influence that the U.S. government might have in transparency, both in implementation, where it's been adopted, and more to the point, where it's still emerging and yet to be adopted, what do you think that the U.S. can or should do to try to increase or even restore its influence in the world, the influence that it once had not so many years ago? This is just a warm-up for our final panel of the day.
I've got my...
Sorry, influence on the FOI agenda? Or
on the development, on the proliferation of transparency worldwide, and also helping other nations that do implement something in their implementation process.
Yeah, I'll take a stab. I mean, I think it's just tough sledding right now. I mean, it's no secret. I mean, I think a change in administration, honestly, regardless of who wins, is just going to help.
You said it's no secret, or it is a secret?
No, it's no secret. I mean, I hate having on my business card Washington D.C. is the capital, not because I'm anti-American, but just it invites all kinds of just angst and sort of neuralgia. Even though you know we're very international, we've got 650 people in 90 countries, it still just generates a certain visceral reaction. So I just think time will heal some of this, and you know, regardless of your politics or who wins, I think it will move us a little bit beyond the problem. So, yeah, some of it's just going to take time.
Well, you've said angst, and Kevin turned red, I could see, from even the suggestion.
I was thinking back to some of the presentations I've given, which really, along the lines of explaining how a FOIA request goes in the United States, talks about many of the areas in which we've had problems. I mean, not just political problems in terms of increasing secrecy due to national security concerns or perceived national security concerns, but just things like just delays due to backlog and increasing backlog. And again, that's back to infrastructure. But really, I think back to one speech where I was. I mean, it was the height of, right before the 2004 elections, the height of frustration as you saw where we were hurtling to this inevitable consequence of what was gonna happen. And I'm talking about how angry I've gotten as the way the FOIA situation has been in the last 4 years. And I'm in Buenos Aires talking about it to journalists. And apparently that day, the U.S. ambassador to Argentina happened to be attending my speech. And you know, he remarked to someone else at the embassy, it's nice to know we're spending our tax dollars to bring in people who basically badmouth our country. But really, what I think you're right. I think our perception right now is, my God, we're not doing it that well. Let's increase that perception. I'm perfectly happy to talk about where our failings have been, because our system isn't working very well right now.
Can't have you do that, because that truly is subject of the next panel, I think.
It's not all political, and we know it. I mean, it's not just political or national security. It's there are many problems wrong with the U.S. FOIA processing system. Hopefully, we're starting to fix some of those with the Open Government Act. I mean, back then, the Open Government Act hadn't even been proposed, if I recall, by John Cornyn in late 2004. Maybe it was late 2003.
It was December 2004.
Yeah.
That the devil's deal
was
struck.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you know, many of the things I was talking about were there, but I think it was the national security portion was really at an all-time high right then. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of it is regaining that reputation as a leader on these and other democracy issues will help a lot. I mean, it goes without saying after Dan's introduction that you know who I'm probably going to vote for, but I'll tell you what, man. it was amazing to see how much people are following, especially in Africa, how closely they're following this election and who they want to win, and where the U.S. statue will probably be restored in many of these countries. I didn't perceive, as much as I know who I want to win, I didn't perceive it as being that impactful around the world.
Well, on that note, we're very well poised, so to speak, for our next panel that we're going to begin after about a 10 or 15 minute break. We're running a little bit behind schedule, maybe closer to a 10 minute break. But I want to first thank our panelists for this panel very much for not only the precision of your insights, but the candor with which you expressed it as well. Very, very much appreciated, especially in an academic setting, where it is most fitting indeed.
I like watching train wrecks. I like watching